This episode is presented by Invest Puerto Rico. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Hello and welcome back to Equity, a podcast about the business of startups where we unpack the numbers and the nuance behind the headlines. My name is Alex and I'm joined today by senior TechCrunch reporter on the world of fintech. It's Marianne. Hey Marianne, how are you?
I'm good, Alex. How's it going?
Well, winter has returned and my baby's been sick. So it's not that bad. It's just, you know, it's been a long week.
It has been a long week. I second that.
Well, but it has been a long week, but it's getting better because Becca is back with us on Equity. Becca, hi, how are you?
I am good. I also feel like it has been a long week.
Long week in a good way, though, because we do have some very fun news on the show, including some updates on the world of IPOs. But before we get into that, two things. One, please don't forget to drop a rate or review of the show on your favorite podcast application. We do really appreciate it, and we will read out some of the best of those on the show in the coming weeks. And also, Becca, before you jump in, you recently had a very important guest over on Found.
Yes. We recently had Eric Glyman, the co-founder and CEO of Ramp, on the Found podcast. So if you want to hear a little bit more about their founding journey, what it was like building a fintech in 2015 versus building a fintech now, very good conversation and definitely would recommend.
Hard agree on all things Found. We love stealing Becca for Equity whenever we can, but she does have her own show, so we can't take her every single week. But on the pod today, the three of us are going to get into deals of the week, including Onyx, Montauk Climate, Wonder, and the Ethos Fund. Then we're discussing an influx of possible capital into the world of AI from Saudi Arabia. And then recent IPO news and why late-stage VCs may be holding back their portfolio companies from going public. But we're going to start with Onyx, Marianne, a YC-backed company that appears to not be dead.
Well, yes. So Christine Hall first covered the company last May when it raised about $4.1 million in seed funding. And at the time, I will admit, I was a little bit skeptical of the model. That was because they claimed that they were focused as a digital bank, focused strictly on providing banking and investment services for high earning millennials and Gen Zers.
I don't hate that off top, Marianne. Why did that initially strike you as a specious idea?
I don't know. Maybe that high earning somehow rubbed me wrong. It just felt a little exclusionary, which maybe isn't fair because, you know, there are different types of financial institutions for different demographics. But I don't know, it did just strike me as a little different. Anyway, they were supposedly doing pretty well. They told Christine that, you know, things were going well, revenue was going up every month. But then come to find out just last week that they sent their customers an email saying they were terminating bank operations and closing their accounts.
Yeah, that was a surprise. And so we took that along with a note over on the Y Combinator website that marked them as inactive as indication that Onyx was essentially on its way out.
Right. I thought, oh, okay, Onyx is shutting down. You know, that was fast. But when then I reached out to one of the co-founders, he set me straight and said, apparently what they're doing is pivoting. They're pivoting from B2C to B2B, which I'll tell you his exact words, shifting to a B2B white label platform as a service model for community banks, regional banks, and credit unions that want to launch digital apps built for young affluent consumers. Okay, I get the B2B shift. It probably makes more sense. I will say that a source told me behind the scenes that regulatory issues may have played a role in its terminating bank operations. I asked the co-founder about this. He denied that. He said that wasn't the reason. He said that this has kind of been in the works for a little while and that it was a strategic decision that allowed the company to leverage the base of existing financial institutions and use the technology it had built to, quote, scale in a more capital efficient manner.
My first thing here, and I know I'm not bearish on fintech as a category. I need to say that before what I'm about to say, but these sort of like banks aimed at different groups and stuff like that, I still have yet to meet anyone who uses a non-traditional bank. I still have never met anyone. I don't know anyone whose friends use them, whatever. But I like the concept of them for groups, especially those who have been sort of hurt or discriminated against in the traditional banking system. But in this case, if you're targeting high earning millennials and Gen Z, like, aren't these the kind of people where traditional banking models actually are better for them than versus for me? Yeah. So that's always my thing. Also, I'm like, who my age has any money? I'd love to know.
I mean, I was thinking about this in reverse, which is that we've talked about certain neobanks that have stuff for less wealthy people, like getting your payday a few days early. They'll essentially credit you that, and then because they know it's coming in, and then they can pay you back. And it's a way to offer kind of like a flexible solution to avoid payday loans for people who might need that. So there are innovations that are super cool. The thing that I struggle with is kind of what Becca said, which is these people are already so well served.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to figure out how I can phrase this. Like, my bank loves to send me things in the mail that are like, give us more of your money and we will give you some money, because they want me to keep more of my money with them versus elsewhere. And so like they are beating down the door to try to engender more business with me. So it feels like a reasonably served category already. And that's why I think Onyx probably struggled, because there's just myriad options in the market that are already tuned towards the affluent, the high earning, or the Henrys, as they're called on Reddit, the high earners, not rich yet.
I think you both make excellent points. I will say, though, in general, that we've seen more than one shutdown in the space of neobanks that were targeting very specific demographics in the past year alone. We saw Daylight shut down last year. It was focused on the LGBTQ plus community. We also saw Cheese, which was aimed at the Asian American community, shut down very recently. So I think in general, this is a tough thing to do. We see some neobanks doing very well right now. Nubank, Dave, for example, Monzo just raised a bunch of money. But I think it's a really hard thing to do, to target very specific demographics, because you have to be able to differentiate your offerings so that a person feels like it's worth their while to bank with you, as opposed to a larger, more traditional bank, or even a larger fintech bank.
Yeah. And also, the more money you have, the more probably focused you are on capital preservation and account safety. And so you might have a slightly less of an impetus to go out there and try something that's a bit more niche and new. That said, my last point on this is, if you go after a subset of the market, you are kind of limiting your TAM, just kind of by definition. So anyways, tough, but good to see Onyx trying something new. We will have notes on them as we learn more about how their B2B pivot is going. My deal of the week is about a company that we haven't talked about in a while indirectly, which is Casper. Do you guys remember when Casper was like the D2C breakout story? It went public and it seemed like we couldn't get away from different mattress-based companies. That was a whole trend for years, Marianne.
Right. Yeah, it was. It was Casper, Purple.
Avocado.
What happened to Purple? Damn, I haven't heard that in a minute. I wonder how they're doing.
Did they get acquired? Maybe that's true, but they sell them at like Sleep Numbers. Oh, I know that.
There you go.
I don't know if they got acquired by them, but they're definitely doing like retail too.
Well, Casper did go public. It did not have a great time as a public company, but the co-founder of the company, Philip Krim, is back and he's working on a new thing. It's an incubator, not an accelerator, called Montauk Climate. And it just raised about $8.5 million. And the idea here is something akin to the startup studio model. So instead of raising a bucket of capital and then doling it out to founders for shares in return, they are going to work on their own ideas. And then once something is kind of going well, bring in external people to run those businesses and then raise traditional venture capital. This is not the first time we've seen this model, but it is, I think, in my experience, the first time we've seen this applied to the realm of climate. Becca, is anything else come to mind as an example in that area?
No, I think you are right, because this definitely isn't a particularly new strategy, but I think in the climate space, you are right to say that nothing comes to mind as far as anyone else doing this in that sector.
So here's my question, because it's perfectly fine to make a lot of money in a company and try something new, especially if you have a lot of ideas. Do you think you understand kind of how to build companies and how to approach the market, given your learnings? Why not try to do multiple things at once and kind of like not just spread your bets, but also just have more impact? The flip, though, is people love to talk about how founder-led businesses are the way to go. And if you have a startup incubator model and the people who come up with the ideas and do the first incubation aren't the people who run the business long term, it seems to be kind of like directly opposed to the common trend we see of kind of founder first, founder led businesses. And so it feels oddly counter and not narrative per se, but just like it goes against what we've been told is the right way to do things. And I'm struggling to kind of figure out if that's why we haven't seen incubators of this ilk in different areas become the household names we've seen from other venture capital traditional firms.
Yeah. Can you think of any companies who are
born out of incubators
yeah,
and are doing really like, well? you mean?
Yeah, like, that's my question. I don't know, because I know there's a bunch and I know some do better than others, but yeah, I can't think of like a company from one of these off the top of my head.
I think that just goes to show that there's probably some success in this model in certain areas, but not as much as we have seen from other models. I mean, we're going to talk about the Reddit IPO later in the show, but that I think is not even amongst the first dozen IPOs from the YC cohorts throughout the years. So the accelerator model does have a track record you can kind of point to and off the top of your head name names. This is just a little bit different. Though I will say, given the scope of the potential climate issues that we are seeing, I'm in favor of a try everything approach. So I don't want to sound overly negative here. I'm more curious as to why this was the method that they decided to approach. But they built a team, they raised money, they're going to go after climate, and I think that's very cool. I mean, why not? Why not go out there and just try all the things? There's too much carbon in the air, y'all. We need help.
Yeah, in the story, I mean, Tim said that the trio felt like they had plenty of ideas themselves. You know, so that's why they decided to go this route instead of like doing a VC fund. And also, I thought it was interesting that of the 8.5 million they raised, about 7 million of that came from one person, Shield Tile, managing partner at Amplo. I would like to see how this plays out. I think their mission is honorable. I do think that they're trying to take a different approach. They're not focusing on problems that require hardware to solve. They are looking at creating businesses that complement those types of companies.
The analogy they made is that the bricks have already been made. It's all about, you know, kind of laying them correctly and finding the mortar that goes between them to hold them all together. Ergo, we've already lowered the cost of solar production dramatically and improved the efficiency of it. So what can we do with that? Well, probably quite a lot. So Montauk Climate, one to keep an eye on. I want to bring up one more small thing from another serial founder, just kind of keeping that theme alive. And that is Mark Lohr. Now, you might remember him from Quidsy, which he sold, and then Jet.com, which he also sold. The latter deal was a multi-billion dollar sale to Walmart. Now, Mr. Lohr is back, and you may have heard of his company called Wonder. It had just raised $700 million, Becca, in a safe. And I think that they screwed up, because safes are for single-digit million-dollar transactions, not double-digit, let alone triple-digit million-dollar deals. What's going on?
Yeah, that is way, way, way too much money to raise in a safe, in my opinion. Safes, especially with this whole like hitting milestone with that much money, I mean, in today's market, especially, this is in a very, very crowded category.
So tell us about Wonder, because I'm curious why you think that.
So mainly focused on sort of a new way to do food delivery. I know they originally were trying to launch a food truck network that did not really pan out. There's so many food delivery, like living in a place like I do, New York City, where it would be a perfect market for a food delivery company. There are so many. And sometimes I pass restaurants still with signs outside that say you can get us delivered on this app exclusively. And I'm like, I have never heard of that app. So it's just like, if none of these companies are doing amazing, like, it's not like you can be like, well, look at Uber Eats, look at DoorDash, they're doing crazy numbers, like the market is so big, clearly can have more players. That isn't really what happens in this category. So, I mean, the food truck would have been a niche. That didn't work out. That's fine. But otherwise, I'm kind of like, what's the differentiator here?
Yeah, and just in general, I mean, $700 million is a lot of money these days. And I, too, was very surprised to see it raised via SAFE. That just feels odd.
Unsafe.
Oh, God. Becca with the dad jokes. I have a solution, though. What if we took these two stories and did a bit of a remix? So I'm going to read these headlines now, but I'm going to change the numbers around. Montauk Climate raises $700 million and Wonder's Mark Lohr raises 8.5. There we go. I fixed it.
That feels better.
More money for climate, less money for whatever Wonder becomes. Shout out Mark Lohr, though, for being one of the best fundraisers in the history of mankind. Gotta hand it to the guy. I'm impressed that he pulled this off. But let's move on. And we're going to talk about a new venture capital firm called Ethos Fund. Becca, what's going on?
Yeah. So Ethos Fund just closed its first fund, which is going to invest in founders bridging the gap between the US and Vietnamese tech communities. So the firm's about 2 years old. They raised $12 million. The fund will invest in companies in two different ways. They'll both invest in companies based in Vietnam that are really, really early stage, pre-product, pre-revenue, as well as companies in the US, which they're calling third culture founders. So they've described that, direct quote, brilliant minds who don't just belong to one culture, but have been shaped by multiple ones, solving problems that they care about. I think this is interesting for a whole host of reasons. One, I love these funds that work to bridge gaps between an established market like the US and a less established market, say like Vietnam. There's another one I talk to quite often that is trying to do the same thing with startups in Poland. It's called Smok Ventures. They have some partners based out in Silicon Valley. They have partners based in Warsaw, and they're trying to bridge the gap there. And I think that's a really smart strategy to get international exposure to these smaller markets and kind of give the boost that they maybe wouldn't have gotten otherwise, just trying to home grow their own market.
Yeah, one thing I've heard about this kind of in reverse is people trying to help other founders break into the US market. But it's cool to see kind of the US and Vietnam to be bridged, especially given that Vietnam is emerging as a place where people are moving some of their operations in light of China becoming a more difficult country to do business in. So to me, there's kind of a thematic geopolitical element to this that makes a lot of sense. But I will never, ever, ever be unhappy to see very early stage founders raise more money around the world, because that's where the cool ideas come from. So I think this is great.
I think so, too. I was surprised, though, to see that the founders of this firm are actually Korean.
That is definitely surprising.
I mean, not that it's a bad thing, but I was just not expecting it. So I was like, interesting that they chose Vietnam and not Korea to focus their efforts on.
Well, South Korea has, due to its large companies, a lot of, I mean, just to pick one example, a lot of corporate venture capital already. And so maybe Vietnam is just a market where there was more opportunity, mm-hmm. and that just means essentially need from founders for this type of funding.
Makes sense.
Yeah. And I was going to say, too, maybe this plays into a whole third culture founder piece of this. Like, they're mm-hmm. both not from that country, but they've lived in a few different areas, like, and they're investing there. But I just wanted to touch on that a little bit, too. I love the concept of these quote unquote third culture founders, because something I've always thought that was interesting is, well, there's evidence here in the US, there are firms that just invest in immigrant founders. There's definitely a lot of data you can look at, big success stories in the US startup market that come from founders with those types of backgrounds. But I've always thought, if you want to scale your company out of whatever country you're based in, you do kind of want more of that global mindset, or you do kind of maybe want those experiences that would help shape your thinking as you are thinking about an expansion. Of course, many examples of how you don't absolutely need that, of course, not a requirement by any means, but I could definitely see how investing in people who have that background, have that mindset to begin with, might approach their company building differently, especially if they do plan to expand down the line. And I could see the benefits from that, of coming with that approach.
Yeah, absolutely. And the inaugural fund is $12 million. They've already made some investments out of that. So Ethos Fund, one to watch. We'll see who follows in their footsteps, if anyone, because there's more countries out there that we could bridge between. Now, when we come back, Saudi Arabia's big AI push, but very first, a short break. What's next in tech? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's an innovations paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/TechCrunch. Now, Saudi Arabia is planning an enormous push into the world of artificial intelligence using its sovereign wealth fund. Becca, we're talking about $40 billion here, which I would have said a few years ago is probably too much money. But given how much we've seen OpenAI and Anthropic and others raise, I almost want to say $40 billion, that's it.
I know. In today's market, they can make like three investments. I'm kidding, but like, I'm not really kidding as much as I wish I was.
Yes.
I'm not surprised, though. I mean, the Saudi Arabian government has definitely proven over the last few years, one, they definitely want to get more into venture investing and innovation and the like in general. But two, they've proven to be pretty smartly reactive and kind of following the trends and putting their money in certain areas that are kind of following broader trends in the innovation ecosystem. You don't always see that to people who come in making these big pushes. Sometimes it's like, oh, we want to stay general. Oh, we're trying to figure it out. So it is interesting to see them come in with this AI focus. I feel like it's a very, if you have that kind of money to spend, it's a smart reaction to where the market's headed.
Yeah, I wonder if there's a national element to this, because we've talked a lot about, you know, like chip production being now a thing that every country wants to have inside of its borders and so forth. I wonder if AI is going to become a thing that at least regions want to have local champions for, and if some of this money could go to fostering, incubating, accelerating something inside of Saudi Arabia that would give the Middle East something akin to an AI model, even though I know this money is also going to go into like Andreessen Horowitz.
Yeah. You know, somehow I doubt that a little bit. I feel like all the efforts are going to be focused probably more on the country itself, not necessarily the region as a whole. But of course, I could be wrong. I do think, yeah, $40 billion is a lot of money. Agreed, Pekka, that it seems like a smart move. But, you know, also let's keep in mind, probably a lot of investment going into AI right now is not going to pan out into anything tangible. I mean, the information reported, I think it was yesterday, that Cohere, after raising, oh gosh, I don't remember the numbers offhand, but a lot of money, only had about $13 million in revenue last year.
Yeah, they're targeting multi-billion valuation off of that.
Right. I mean, that just, I'll be honest with you, that kind of thing just pisses me off. When there are companies that are like generating hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue and, you know, struggling to raise capital for whatever reason, but just because this is more of a flashy space, you know, and they only have $13 million in revenue, but they can command that sort of capital. I guess it's the potential that investors are backing. But anyway, it's just a point that I had to make. So like $40 billion, yes, a lot of money. But how much of that is going to actually go into technologies or companies that pan out to do something, you know, meaningful?
Well, one way to get around the selection risk you're describing is to give it to large venture capitalists that have a track record. And Andreessen Horowitz has been in and around Saudi Arabia saying kind things about them because they are an enormous potential LP. So we at least know one firm that would like a chunk of this.
Mm-hmm. And to bring up the point you mentioned earlier, Alex, about maybe countries and regions do kind of want their own AI champion. One thing I think about that is so prevalent in the AI discussion today and somehow could probably be more prevalent than it is just the privacy and security aspects that come with training large language models. And if you wanted to use AI applications in your government or to automate things like that, like you probably would want a local player and you probably would want someone who's not working with other governments, even though I do know of a few AI startups that do automate some government processes that do work with multiple different governments, which I definitely think is really interesting. But I could see certain things people kind of would want to keep it close to the vest.
Yeah. And don't think that we're being alarmist. Like, just look at changing data residency rules and how those could play into training of LLMs and how those could become regionally specific to a really material degree. But here we have a country that isn't super populous, like, say, India, which is having its own AI regulatory discussion, showing up with a lot of capital to make a difference. I am very curious to see who they invest in and then how people react to the Saudi Sovereign Wealth Fund being the original source of their eventual capital and if that will play into founder decisions. But certainly, this is going to be another big year for AI investment. So more money just makes sense to me, Becca.
Yeah. And what you just brought up about who they're going to back and stuff like that is a good point, because I know I was just talking to someone over at StepStone and they were saying that one of the big things they've noticed from 2023 that's rolling into this year that they expect will continue to grow throughout 2024 is that firms are struggling to fundraise, and firms who have said we would never take money from not just Saudi Arabia in general, but we won't take Middle Eastern money, we just will not raise from that region, are reversing that decision. So if this fund goes out to look for managers, there are actually probably going to be a lot more managers in the US who are willing to take the call, willing to take the discussion than if, say, they had launched this 4 years ago.
Yes. Yes. And there is some history about why 4 years ago or 5 years ago is an important date to keep in mind. But let's move on and talk about late stage venture capitalists and why they may be holding back some of the companies we all want to see SEC filings from going public. Becca, you had a great story about this.
Yeah. So one of the things that I know has been a big conversation since the market originally started to kind of sour back in 2022 is notable people like Hong's Tun at GGV Ventures were coming out and saying like, oh, raising a down round is fine. Like, it's okay to go at a lower valuation and stuff like that. So with how backed up the IPO pipeline was, you started to hear people kind of echoing the same thing about a public listing. Like, we should start seeing more IPOs, even if they're not at the levels of where the companies raised their last primary round. But the issue with that is that some of those companies, even if they want to go public, they might not be able to. Chatting with some VCs, some secondaries folks, and a lawyer as well, discovered that a lot of really standard deal terminology actually gives their most recent round investors a lot of power. And that's not saying you can put in direct rights to give yourself power as an investor to completely block an IPO, which the lawyer I spoke to was like, you used to see that. You don't really see that anymore. But standard stuff like anti-dilution causes, protection and stuff like that alone, automatically you get diluted if you start raising money, you start putting out shares for people to buy pre-IPO. So that gives people that power in a way that maybe some startups didn't realize at the time, because this is such standard terminology. So even if you're a company, you're at 70% of your last valuation, you can see yourself growing strongly in the public market, you want to go public, some of those companies may be being told no.
Yeah. The thing that really blew my mind here is that we have criticized founders on this show for being, you know, slow to go public, but maybe we should have been pointing the finger another direction.
Yeah, I was surprised, Becca. I always learn from you. I was a little surprised. I think, like you said, Alex, we always thought it was the opposite, right? That the VCs were pushing companies to go public so they could get their exit, and that it was the founders holding back. So this was really interesting to me. And I wonder how often it is the case. I also wonder, as a founder, like, is that sort of thing not spelled out more clearly? Like, I can't imagine, like, you go through this whole process of a fundraise and bringing on investors and not understanding that this could happen.
Yeah, no, that is a really good point. And I feel like that's why it's important to stress here with this piece, which I tried to do a lot in the article and definitely want to do now, is just how common these terms are. Because it's like, we've talked a lot over the last year about investors coming in with, say, a 3x liquidation preference or a full ratchet clause or something like that. That's like a very predatory term, whereas a lot of these aren't. These are just things where it's like, if you signed that deal in 2021, you don't know the market's turning in 2022. You expect to go public before that happens. These are things you would not think about. I mean, of course, people should plan for every scenario when they take new rounds, take on new funding. Of course, people should do that. That's basic business 101. But a lot of people don't. And a lot of people have proven, especially in the past few years in the startup market, that they maybe weren't really thinking about the potential downside. Because how could you? After 8-9 years of up and to the right, even though we all know the market is a cycle, it never stays going up and to the right. But one of the people I spoke to this piece, Alan Vaxman over at LaunchBay Capital, made the good point where he was saying that, one, more friction around this happens even in a good market than people are willing to talk about. And two, he was saying at the end of the day, VCs have a fiduciary responsibility to their LPs. So if you're private, Stripe's the perfect example here. Stripe last raised a primary round, $90 billion valuation. Obviously, they're not there yet. They raised, or two rounds ago, $90 billion. Their last round, $50 billion. They recently had that secondary sale, priced them at $65 billion. That secondary sale pretty much proves they won't go public. Because that round proves to their investors that if they stay private, they can continue to build that valuation back up. Maybe it won't hit the $90 billion, but if they went public today, people who need to cash out relatively quickly, early investors, et cetera, they are actually leaving money on the table. And that's not something VCs want their LPs to think that they're doing.
Yeah, but you don't have to immediately liquidate your holdings when a company goes public, so you could hold post-IPO and still enjoy value creation. All that's to say is that there's no single simple answer to this. Every situation is different, but it does show that there is more investor control over exit timing than we may have anticipated. And I think you're right, going back in time to people not thinking this through, because back in the day, you could always raise more money at a higher price. So who cares about this set of terms when you're already talking about the next one? And now, you know, it's kind of, oh, well, maybe we should have thought of that. I will say, though, if you are a VC holding back a company going public because you're worried about the price, well, there's been some good news, which is that we had two IPOs this week, Reddit and Astera Labs, and they did incredibly well. In fact, Becca, we're recording this Thursday afternoon, which we always do. Reddit just began to trade. What's going on there?
Yeah, so Reddit, I'm looking at the numbers updating live at this exact second. It looks like it's about up 52%. Last one I'm going to look at for this exact second is $51.83 for the price per share, which is a lot higher than what Reddit went out for, also a lot higher than I think a lot of people expected them to be able to go public at and did not expect them to go well.
Yes.
Going public at this price.
I'm doing some math in my head. If their fully diluted valuation was like 6.4 at $34 a share, they're worth like 9-10 billion now, which means they're almost back on a fully diluted basis to their last private round valuation.
That was
fast. Yeah, all this is to say that don't be so afraid. You know, come on, let's go. Like, we just had two IPOs from venture-backed tech companies this week that both priced at either the top of the range or above it and had great first-day debuts. What more can people ask for? I can't imagine.
Right. What more? We need more. More IPOs.
Yes. please drop those S1 filings. They take tons of time to go through and to plan around and so forth. So yeah, keep us working late. Flood us with those IPOs. We'd love to see them.
At least have a good reason to work late. An S1 would fall into that. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see how this goes from here, because I know even when Reddit had filed and people, especially secondaries investors I spoke to, were pretty hopeful that the IPO would go well. Like, they didn't think it would go probably as well as it is currently, but they were like, no, we have good reason to believe that company has a lot of revenue, even though it's not profitable. They're going out at a multiple that is much more reasonable than they would have gone out if they had gone public, say, in 2021. But I don't know if any of those secondaries investors realized how well these two IPOs were going to go, because they were all saying, even if these do go well, we're really not sure that's enough to really open the IPO window. But when they said IPO is going well, they didn't mean popping 47%.
No, so, not at all.
I don't know.
You wrote a piece not that long ago, Becca, going through how secondary markets indicated that a $5 billion valuation was pretty much where people thought Reddit would be worth. And it turns out that public markets are going to public market, and everyone, at least for today, looks very conservative in hindsight.
Mm-hmm. Because the key with the $5 billion valuation is, not only is that something people were willing to buy in at, that would also be a price that people could realistically start to buy into to grow. Because they're saying, obviously, if you price too high, people aren't sure. They're not going to buy. Price is going to drop. Valuation is going to drop. So they priced a little bit higher than that $5 billion range. And seeing them pop the way they are now means maybe we don't know what we're talking about when it comes to that.
Well, I don't think anyone ever knows how to price an IPO, because either you nail it and it's boring, you are a little bit low and it pops too much and everyone complains about money left on the table, or you price it too high and raise more and then it goes down and everyone's sad. So there's almost like no perfect way. The only way to make make sense is to wait 6 months and then look at the price and then try to measure how it was priced compared to where it actually landed. Early enthusiasm, though, is a generally bullish signal. And so we're not going to denigrate it. I'm not looking forward to the did money get left on the table conversation coming back again, because I feel like we do that every 3 years. But at least we've had two IPOs this week. It's been a lot of fun. And guys, we got to go. But Equity will be back on Monday. Becca, tell people where to find your Found podcast.
Yeah, definitely. You can find us on Twitter. We're just at Found. You can find us off the TechCrunch website under the podcast, where maybe you are already going to catch up on Equity. We are there as well. And yeah, always happy to come on the show.
Yeah. And we will have IPO coverage all over the TechCrunch website. So if you're listening to this Friday morning, well, go read TechCrunch.com. We have lots of stuff for you. Thank you all very much. Of course, we are Equity Pod over on X and Threads. And the TechCrunch podcast network is on TikTok under the name TechCrunch Pods. Thank you all. Goodbye.
Bye.
Equity is hosted by myself, Alex Wilhelm, and TechCrunch senior reporter, Mary Ann Azevedo. We are produced by Teresa Loconsolo with editing by Kel. Bryce Durbin is our illustrator. And a big thank you to the audience development team and Henry Picavet, who manages TechCrunch audio products. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.